Hello and welcome to the Right Dishonourable podcast, as truthful as resources permit. Jazza, did you prefer Jennifer Lopez at the US inauguration ceremony, or were you more a Lady Gaga fan?
I mean, I'm obviously a Lady Gaga fan. You have to ask me who Jennifer Lopez is.
Who is Jennifer Lopez?
I don't know her. And if you don't get that reference, then frankly, you're not a homosexual. But obviously, Lady Gaga was better. I mean, I think it was really... I loved the J-Lo... What did she said? She like, sang like it was the most beautiful thing on the face of the planet. She sang, "Get Loud!" At some point in the song, which I don't think is actually part of the lyrics. And then Gaga just did the perfect, no notes, beautiful, star-spangled banner, didn't she?
I mean, I think praising a double summit on a notes is pretty low bar from my point of view. That's the minimum I expect from a singer, is not to come out with a sheet of paper.
Oh, okay. Well, fair enough. Who was your favourite, Jimmy?
I thought found them both kind of underwhelming. I mean, I did enjoy how BBC commentator kept referring to J-Lo as a prominent Latina woman, as though that was like the only interesting thing she could think about her.
It is the only interesting... I shouldn't say that.
But I thought you said you didn't know her, Jazza.
Sorry, I mean, exactly. Welcome to the Right Dishonourable podcast, where we meet bi-weekly to talk about politics, social issues, and the current events. This week we are with guest. Say hello, Turi.
Hello, everybody.
Hello, Turi. So, essentially, we're sometimes we have a serious guest on who has a relevant background in maybe one of the topics that we are discussing. Generally, Jimmy will source those guests. And sometimes they just happen to be the nationality of one of the topics that we want to talk about and be a friend of mine. And that is the case of Turi, correct?
Exactly.
And what is your, if you don't mind sharing, what is your national background?
I am Dutch, so I'm from the Netherlands.
Ah, Nurken in de Kurken to you too.
Yes, that's how you say hello in the Netherlands. Everybody who travels there should always say it.
Yes, 100%. And Dutch people don't hate it at all.
Depends on how you pronounce it. I mean, it always makes me laugh when British people say Nurken in de Kurken. I don't know if everybody is going to feel that way. Mm-hmm. I can't imagine not finding it funny, but yeah.
In the wrong context, I can imagine it being grating at the very least. Maybe if you work behind as a receptionist in a hotel, for example, and every kind of like stag do thinks it's very funny to have that as like the way that they say hello. No kidding, the Coke, and by the way, Jimmy. And other non-Dutch speakers, because obviously I'm fluent, means fucking in the kitchen.
And it sounds nice. Even in Dutch, it sounds pretty nice.
Do you do a lot of fucking in the kitchen in Holland and the Netherlands?
Is that I do it overly a lot, but I mean...
It comes up.
Okay, moving swiftly on from sex life. Today, we are going to be speaking about three topics. The first of all is going to be Turi specific, and we're going to be talking about the fact that the Dutch government has decided to resign en masse, but it was a month before the election. It was a couple of months before the election anyway. So really, what was the point?
Is this how you want me to start?
No, well, like this is the teaser, Turi.
Yeah,
so you've just got to
a taste of your views on this subject.
Yeah. Give us the TLDR.
Essentially, this is how, if there is a crisis, most Dutch governments end, just before an election. Or relatively close time before an election.
What a coincidence. But essentially, Rutte, who's been the head of the government, who's been the prime minister for the past 10 years, right?
Yeah, the last three governments.
It probably, even despite this huge scandal... to do with the payments and repayments of child support, which is just the kind of really boring administrative political story that I really miss from like pre-2015. Do you know what I mean? But it looks like he's going to have minimal... Yeah, thank you. He's going to have minimal repercussions and continue to be Prime Minister. Anyway, Jimmy, what else are we going to be talking about today?
Oh, I've totally forgotten whether we're doing the America story second or not.
Can you make... professionalism, who really fucking cares? Let's do the America story second.
Okay, as some of you may have been aware, Joe Biden has replaced the Oompa Loompa as President of the United States. Some of you probably even watched the inauguration ceremony on the 20th of January, which, as we referenced in the opening to this, included Jennifer Lopez and Lady Gaga. Some other people were there, I assume. So Joe Biden is now the president. I think Jazza is just desperate to get into the nitty-gritty of what his presidency is going to entail.
It's just, again, it's just quite nice for stuff to be just a tiny bit normal, despite the fact that there is still a global pandemic going on, and the US obviously is one of the worst hit countries. It's nice to see that there is someone close to an adult involved. Well, and leading the helm in the US now.
I mean, septuagenarian is sort of on the other side of adulthood, I would say.
He's
transcended into something else.
Oh, dear. Well, we'll try and avoid just talking about how old Joe Biden is. And we will instead maybe look at some of the initial steps that he has gone to in order to roll back the age of Trump. Thank God. And then finally, Jimmy, this was suggested by you, I believe.
I thought there was a segment about orange people somewhere in here, but I don't think I can find it. Essentially, there have been a lot of discussions around this four lads meme, which is a photo that circulated the internet sometime last year. I think it was slightly before that, of these four super toned, tattooed men in like skinny clothing on a night out. Which has prompted some discussions about it's sort of like become a stand-in. Some people have like linked it to, say, slightly reactionary conservative political views. Some people have made fun of them just for like caring too much about their appearance. But one of the reasons that I thought this was interesting is that friend of the podcast, Brendan O'Neill of Spike.
He's not a friend of the podcast. He's just a jumping off point for too many of the stories that piss me off, and so you keep on suggesting his bloody column.
I don't know what you mean, but he wrote in The Spectator that this the way this meme had been sort of circulated on the internet was evidence of insidious class-based hatred from the yuppie middle class people who he rails against in his almost every column that he writes,
whereas I just fancy them.
Yeah, so we're going to be talking about those two interpretations of this meme.
the two extremes of this story. Either you think that this is clearly a depiction of the Hampstead elite pushing up their like snooty nose, looking down on the quote-unquote working class lads preening themselves and looking good on a night out, or you want to fuck them all. Turi, on which edge of the debate, just quickly before we dive into the intro, do you want to fuck them or do you turn up your nose at these four gentlemen?
I'm in the ambivalent. I definitely don't want to fuck them, but maybe not interested enough to stick up my nose at them. But
hey, you are missing out on the former. Let me tell you. And as I can reveal, I've had sex with all. I haven't.
But have you tried?
I grew up in Essex, Turi. I don't know how far that stereotype has travelled, if it's gone over the English Channel, but I grew up with lads like this, and it's why I fancy them, because it was all I had between the ages of like 10 and 20.
This has taken a slight turn already, so I think we should probably move on as fast as possible, play some music, tell you about the Patreon accounts, and get on with the main segment.
Sick. Great. Let's do it.
Long-suffering fans of the Writers Honourable podcast will know that we have run a Patreon account for some time. This allows listeners to give us some money per episode, usually just a dollar or two, as it's in US currency. And that allows us to pay for things like hosting, occasionally microphones, just the standard gubbins that you need to keep a podcast online these days. One of the benefits that we've introduced recently are bonus segments. So every time we release an episode, we add an extra segment just for our patrons. You can access that by going to patreon.com/rightdishonorable. Another benefit is that during this part of the show, you will get your name read out, which some of you may not think is a benefit, but you know, different strokes for different folks. So without further ado, I would like to thank our existing patrons, Alexander Wood, Andrew Kilpatrick, David Preston, Gemma Cumming, John O. Matt, and Michael Costa. Thank you very much for supporting the show. On a slightly cheeky note, I've just launched a Substack newsletter, just like any other journalist at the moment. You can access that by going to jdenichols.substack.com. Basically, I will be writing about things that interest me. So if you enjoy my random thoughts on the podcast, you might also enjoy things that are going on there. And I'll also be pointing to other bits and pieces that I've done, freelance journalism, stuff that's going on with the podcast. So kind of a behind the scenes thing, and also some free articles for you. So please sign up if you're interested. Siri, if you had to break this down for a non-Dutch specialist audience, which is essentially what I'm asking you to do, how would you describe it? What is the scandal here exactly that has led to the Prime Minister resigning?
In short, the scandal is that since about 2013, somewhere between 20 and 30,000 families have been treated as if they were fraudulent in receiving childcare benefits. And these people have been pulled through the ringer and treated in a very bad way. And as a result, their lives in many ways have been ruined since those years.
I read that there were some of the anecdotal consequences of how the Dutch government treated them. Or more specifically, I guess a lot of it is being put on the civil servants more than the actual government, right?
It's yes, and yes and no. It depends on how you want to look at it. I have to rewind because Jim, you asked me to do it in short, but it's a thing that's been going on for some time. So since from 2010 to 2013, there was a different scandal in the Netherlands with fraud on the welfare system by Bulgarian mobsters, essentially. And they sort of embezzled about 4 million euros. So in 2013, the Dutch government decided, and the Dutch parliament decided, there needs to be very strict laws. And one of the things that they decided was that if there is a suspicion of fraud, a person should be treated as fraudulent.
Oh, so it was like, it was guilty until proven innocent.
Essentially,
that's a fucking Star Trek episode. That's not real life. What are you playing at?
Yeah, no, but that's what happened. So, yes, and then these people were, and it's also very problematic that all of them seem to come from specific ethnic backgrounds or specific names. So they might have, you know, Turkish last names or Moroccan last names, but they'll speak with just a local Dutch accent from somewhere, a few generations down. But they were still. They seem to have been targeted to some degree.
Mm-hmm. Was there evidence that they were targeted?
We don't know. I don't know if there was any definitive evidence, but the statistical amount of those people that have been treated as being scamming the system, but were not, you could see that there were a lot of those same names, types of people in there, and that was very problematic.
Mm-hmm. And how were they treated differently once they were seen as possibly being fraudulent, possibly based on their last name?
Yeah. So first off, because there are families that are getting child benefits, childcare benefits, these are already sort of more vulnerable families, right? Because otherwise you don't get it. So what happened if they were suspected of being fraudulent? They would have to first pay back all the money that they'd got to that point, which could be money that they did not have. And they would be put on lists saying that they are known scammers, fraudeurs is what we say, but I'm blanking on what the...
Fraudsters.
Fraudsters, yeah. So that they became on these lists, so it becomes very difficult to get certain loans from banks, things like this. Additionally, it brings a lot of stress on families. So a lot of these people also lost their jobs in this process, because you have to imagine they were constantly being chased by the government for a period of well, let's say 5 years, give or take a bit per case. So, and you, when you hear the testimonials, there are people's lives who were, very much ruined or, made quite horrible. And then the question that you were asking about, was it the civil servant's fault or was it the politician's fault? The annoying thing is this, so they did a whole, inquest to find out what happened. And everybody pretty much said, well, we didn't know this was going on. So everybody pretty much put up their hands saying it wasn't my direct fault. And this is, of course, very problematic because this inquest committee was pretty much saying, okay, so all of this stuff happened, but all of you are saying, well, I didn't know this at the time, or I was not aware of this at the time. And that, of course, brought a lot of frustration with a lot of people because somebody has to own up to it. And yeah, then it becomes a question of what do you do? Then to go back to what happened this year then, because that report came out in December. It is, and I'm giving you the short version. What happened in December, so this came out just before Christmas. And you have to imagine, this is one of the biggest scandals in Dutch politics for at least the last five, if not the last decade or two even. Because it's massive. So many people have been affected by it. So then it came out just before Christmas, so then nothing happened. But people were saying, okay, the government has to step down and take some responsibility. So the former government that put this into effect, this law, was the Dutch VVD, so one of the current main ruling party, plus...
And it...
Yeah, and they probably still will be after the next election, which...
Good for them.
And are they like the Conservative Party, the sort of centre-right party, or...?
They are the sort of... They are the centre-right party. It's difficult to make them the same as the UK Conservatives.
They're the David Cameron Conservatives.
Yes, I would say that's fair.
Like, they're the more liberally-minded Conservative part of the Conservative Party. Because then there's, like, not to Britsplain Dutch politics, but then basically there's, like, the Christian Conservatives, of which there, like, are a couple of... Because, of course, the Christians need to split stuff up. There's a couple of Christian ones. And then there's the crazy racists, which is Geert Wilders.
We have two of those now.
Oh, fun. Cool. So,
That's politics without splintering of political wings. I mean, you always have to have a bit of that.
Sure, of course. So if this... How does... I don't understand how... Rutte
would be the way to properly pronounce
Rutte.
Rutte.
Like Van Gogh. Rutte. Sure, thank you. He didn't realise this was going to be a language lesson. How does he survive... How does he get away with this? Because surely the buck stops at him. There was already the minister who was in charge of this during during the period that was being analysed by the inquiry. The Labour minister has already resigned, right, and hasn't been part of the government for a while. So
he's now in the parliament, and he was going to be. During the upcoming election, he was going to be the party head of the Labour Party.
Right.
So he has withdrawn from the election because of this, because it was right under his ministry at the time he was the minister of it.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So he was, to be fair, not really a credible candidate after all of this came out, also under his watch. But yeah, Rutte is, I mean, we've now had, this is the end of the third Rutte government, and it seems very likely we're going to have a fourth.
Mm-hmm.
He is a very popular politician. That's the first thing. I would also argue he's a very good politician and a very good prime minister, but he's also kind of made of Teflon in many ways. Like things sort of slide off him. And the thing is, with this scandal, you would think that this would stick, but it doesn't seem to be sticking.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very tricky because his whole philosophy of his last three governments has been, actually for him, it's been an interesting year because this year has tested sort of his ideology more than I think any other year ever has, because he's a proper liberal and his idea has always been sort of, individual responsibility.
Mm-hmm. The party's called Democracy and Freedom.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah.
Yeah.
It does exactly what it says on the tin.
Exactly. But what, and his idea is, okay, so you have to be accountable to yourself, and the government's role should only be to make sure that people are safe and that the government, that the country is running in an economically friendly way, and then everything else will work, right? Mm-hmm. But of course, in 2020, first off, we had, of course, the corona outbreak. And then his original approach was very much, okay, we'll do it in a liberal way. I'll tell you some simple rules that you have to follow, and everybody should stick to it, and then we're fine. And we're, and then they also said, we're not going to we're not going to enforce them that strictly. These things were said a few times.
Because did they like, talk about the? Did they talk about Sweden and herd immunity very much at the beginning? Because that's what our, ours loved herd
immunity. Herd immunity was a big thing, which we now know did not work because Sweden is not doing very hot. So, I don't think it turned out very well.
Interesting. This is a bit of an asterisk, but herd immunity also, from epidemiologists' point of view, is what you get when you have vaccinated everybody. It's not what you get before there's a vaccine. But anyway, please continue.
So for him, and of course that entire policy approach failed, essentially. I mean, it didn't really work. People didn't stick to the rules that much. I was always surprised. Of course, now I'm living in Belgium where it's a different type of approach. But in Netherlands, it was very laissez-faire. And then you just now see that these skyrocketing numbers. And then at the same time, you have this crisis of this welfare benefits, which was, of course, also something that his party was very much focused on, you know, making sure that fraudsters get taken down. You know, it's also a very, I think it's similar to the UK Conservatives, you know, everybody
austerity,
but we also have to make sure that all the freeloaders get taken in. And there's a direct correlation between the approach of let's get fraudsters in the most strict way we can, and that a huge swath of innocent people get put into that as well. And the fact that after all of that, he can still now has a huge lead, like the first party that comes after him in all the polls is still a 20 seat difference, is kind of baffling. But also, if you look at Dutch political history, not that surprising.
So the Netherlands, I don't know how the Senate is elected, but the lower house that produces the government, they are elected fully proportionately. So you only vote for parties, right, on a national basis.
For parties and for specific persons, you can give someone your preference vote.
Right. Okay. And so it's like a fully proportionate system based on percentage of what parties people vote for.
Yeah.
Is this, to a certain extent, are we seeing a limitation of a fully proportionate system that basically allows for there to be no real accountability and for there to be kind of like this continuity in government? Whereas with I can't believe I'm making the case for first past the post. With first past the post, if there is a big political scandal, then the government is held accountable, not kind of like a series of parties that make up a government. And then they can be voted out. You basically are allowed to have a referendum on the governing party.
I mean, I think to be fair, you could probably overstate the accountability of incumbent governments in the UK. Even though what Jazza said does seem correct. But what do you think, Thierry?
Well, in the Netherlands, it's more, I understand why if you'd look at it from that, it might be, but it's a bit something different because sort of we have the same concept as you have in the UK. The idea is you have a government and then you have the opposition that's supposed to check government together. But even because of course we have coalitions, we never have a single party that rules the whole thing. Even those members in parliament need to keep their own government, their own cabinet accountable. Now, one of the things that the inquest has found, and was one of the big problems, is that on the one hand, the parties who are in the coalition have the majority. So they are disincentivized to ask difficult questions to the coalition of which they are a member, right? And the second thing, and this is probably the biggest problem, is that the transparency of information from the government to all parties in the lower house is very limited, was very limited, and has been found to be very, like, it added to this problem. Because the opposition parties were not so good at getting the information they needed to be able to track this thing, these problems down, they weren't able to effectively be in opposition in this topic.
Mm-hmm.
And that's very problematic. On the other hand, it's also very much a culture problem. And culture problem in two ways. One, the Dutch, as a country, we are a very center-right liberal country in most senses. I mean, mm-hmm. some people argue that we're actually a socialist country that just acts like we're a center-right liberal country, but I don't know, you can ask somebody else about that. The thing that happens in that sense is that people feel still this idea of, okay, take the fraudsters down, is very it's very attractive.
Mm-hmm.
And it's still a lot of people follow that. And then now we have this crisis where they still want a government and they still want a prime minister that they trust. And this is what we call the Rutte effect, is because he is prime minister and he is very well liked, he is not getting removed. And as long as, if you look at Dutch history, you will see that many governments have the same head of government for somewhere around 4 or 5 times. This is not a weird thing to have happen. And even if their government fell on a crisis after 2 years, sometimes the same head of state comes back. It's always the question, who is made responsible for the fall of the government? Mm-hmm. It's not all the parties in the government. Sometimes somebody else is made to blame. The funny thing in this situation is, it seems that the Dutch Liberal Party, so the VVD, is not being seen as being responsible. But it's actually the left party, the parties on the left, that are being held, are being looked at, being saying, this is technically your fault. Even though you could argue it's not really their fault.
Haven't the VVD done this before with the D66, where they were in coalition government and all of the bad stuff that went wrong was passed down to the smaller coalition partners, as opposed to the VVD, which kind of like got away with it. It just reminds me of the 2010 to 2015 Condem government.
Yeah.
it just triggers me to conservatives and the Lib Dems working together.
But I do have to say, normally in Dutch politics, it's quite resilient to this effect, in that it doesn't always... Yes, you get a penalty for being in the government, and whoever gets the prime minister tends to be stronger anyway. But the buck doesn't always fall on the same person over and over again, let me put it like that.
It sounds as though you see this as more of a structural problem than anything to do with the specifics of this particular scandal.
I mean, I don't think actually the fall of a government and then having an election is really a structural problem. I mean, this maybe sounds a bit naive, but I see it as democracy at work. I'd rather have, this sounds maybe stupid, but my government falling when it needs to fall because something went wrong, then it's sort of just muddling mm-hmm. onwards until it gets to its end.
A convenient choreographed stumble rather than a fall of government, perhaps.
But I was reading an account of this whole scandal again in The Spectator, and the way it was described, it sounded as though Rutte took responsibility, said, you know, this is our fault. And then he was like, oh, well, I'm going to resign from government, which in British politics would be interpreted as someone saying, I'm going to resign and I'm going to go away because I've done this bad thing. He's just running for office again. And, you know, it sounds as though he's probably going to end up as prime minister again. That doesn't, to me, that seems counterintuitive.
He's got the best of both worlds. Who does he think he is? Hannah Montana.
But this is a very Rutte thing to do. And it's what actually everybody is, not everybody, but a lot of people are attacking him for now, and it's called the Rutte Doctrine, and it consists of two parts. One is that he says, okay, I protect my civil servants, and that civil servants, not everything civil servants does should be put out in the world, and also to give them some protections, you know. And at the same time, he says, okay, I can, as the person who holds this office, I can resign, but unless I was directly the minister who did it, it doesn't mean my career in politics is over. I know, it's if you more you think about it, the weirder it becomes. But because he is so popular, he gets away with it. And
if he doesn't feel it's his fault, he shouldn't resign. That seems to me to be the obvious conclusion.
Yeah, but then you get into like a Priti Patel, where like she is bad at her job. She doesn't think that she's bad at her job, but she still sticks around and refuses to resign.
But there's a logical consistency there. Do you know what I mean? If you're like, I'm resigning, but you know, I'm going to carry on. Like, you wouldn't get that in like football managers, which seems to be the go-to comparison. You know, it's not like I'm going to resign from this job and then apply for it again.
Just one more thing before we move on to the US, Tui. You keep on saying how popular he is. Why? Is it the hair? Is it the fact that he has perfect hair?
I mean, the hair does help.
Mm-hmm.
As someone who is hair challenged, the hair definitely
follicly challenged.
No, I mean, he's on the one hand, he is he has a good appearance. He looks like the exact thing that Dutch people like to see in their politicians. Sure. He wears a suit and a tie, but he is just casual enough that you still think that you can go for a beer with him. But he's also been a fixture of Dutch politics for so long. You buy up clout, and I know Dutch people, we're always considered, you know, we're liberal, progressive, whatever. But the funny thing is, in some senses, we're very conservative because we don't like the change. If the head of state, or not the head of state, but the head of government all of a sudden changes, we don't really like that. And Rutte is sort of this very solid figure that mm-hmm. I'm not a big fan of the VVD, but even I have to admit, he is good at his job. I mean, mm-hmm. you can't really put it in any other way than that.
Mm-hmm. Whereas at least we don't think that Boris Johnson is good at his... I don't know which is better, actually. I feel like you maybe have it better because it's easier for you to just kind of like, oh, you know, I don't agree with him, but at least he's good at his job. Whereas we have the, oh, I don't agree with him, but at least, no, he's bad at his job as well.
But when you live in, when you have a, like, we have a very pluralistic political spectrum, probability you will maybe never see your preferred candidate be the head of state.
That is also what happens, Dewey, when you support the third national party.
Past the post system, then you're never going to see that.
Yeah, I got tempted into liberal democracy in the 2010s. We got into government. I don't think we ever will again. But anyway, speaking about getting into government, let's move on to the large... is it important? Huge shift that we've seen from Trumpism to, I guess we're going to call it Bidenism. We kept on being reminded that his middle name is Robinette, which I would like us to all... Yeah, his name is Joseph Biden... Joseph Robinette Biden Jr. It's a great name. It just makes me think of Robin, the Swedish pop star.
Robinette?
Yeah,
That's a girl's name.
I mean, he is woke. What is gender? It's 2020, Jimmy.
Yeah, but he's like 200 years old, you know. It's not a woke.
When you Google Robinette, you get like a bunch of stuff for in your kitchen or in your bathroom. Like it's a type of faucet.
Oh, well the kind of useless information that we really love to provide on this podcast. He spent quite... First of all, there was an oddly normal-looking inauguration, just minus all of the crowds. So, like, all of the big names were there. Mike Pence turned up, even though Donald Trump decided to do away with, I think, 2 centuries of 100, American...
150 years.
150, time, 150 years yeah. of tradition of
the... existence of most of the country.
Right. It's over half the country's existence, right? Look at us Europeans.
Europeans.
When did you become a country? Oh, that's cute. And we had Lady Gaga sing the national anthem, Jennifer Lopez say something in Spanish. Obviously, Kamala Harris becoming the first woman and the first person of colour to hold the office of vice president as well, which Jimmy doesn't care about. And Biden spent the first couple of days basically reversing Trumpism through executive orders. This, I think, highlights... how weak presidents actually are. If you want to make big sweeping change in the United States, you need to change laws, and in order to do that, you have to have buy-in from the House and the Senate. An example of that is Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, that he pushed through in his first couple of years when he had majorities in both the House and the Senate. And because Trump has kind of struggled with not having consensus both within his own party, but mainly from the last couple of years, not having a majority in the House, he relied on executive orders an awful lot, which ended up being incredibly easy for him, for Biden to then reverse. What do we think about, like, is there a point in doing an executive order for a border wall if then you lose the election and you can't do anything with it anymore?
I mean, I guess Biden must feel that there's a point in doing some executive orders. Yeah, I mean, if it's a tool that a president has, they're going to use it, right? I mean, it obviously is better to get something through Congress because it means that it's less likely to be unraveled in the near future. But no, I don't think it's crazy for somebody to use something like that. I mean, I was interested in your point actually about the, you know, you said Biden's going to unravel Trumpism. There seems to me to be a number of fairly important continuities, in some ways surprising continuities. So one thing that is I actually found very interesting is that there's a recovery bill in the works that The Economist at least thinks is going to end up costing $2 trillion. That's based on a Biden campaign pledge. It may end up costing less than that, more than that, and that's aimed at infrastructure spending. And one of the things that is aimed at is domestic manufacturing for unionized workers, which the unionized bit isn't particularly Trumpy, but the domestic manufacturing is straight out of the Trump playbook, right? Like he talked very much about bringing manufacturing jobs back to the US. And a lot of people said, oh, he's stupid, time is, you know, things have moved on. That's like a sort of anti, you know, it's ahistorical to want it to come back. And yeah, Biden has come out, and that's a fairly major pledge from him and a fairly major thing that he's working on now. So,
but also I feel like that was part of the pitch of Biden, right? Was that he was this Midwestern, I don't know if he, does he have working, probably working class roots? I don't know.
He's not Midwestern. He's from Pennsylvania. It's not Midwestern.
Yeah.
He was born in Delaware, I think.
Yeah, he's technically a Delawarean. And then, oh, I don't know.
He's got Irish Catholic roots. So.
No, sure. Isn't he from Scranton and then he became the senator of Delaware? That's, I think, how it went.
Yes, I think that is correct. He was born in Scranton, Pennsylvania. He was Scranton Joe, I believe, is what some of the American media like to refer to him as. But he's meant to be able to resonate with the American Rust Belt working class, and that's why he ended up being chosen by the through Democratic primary, because they thought that he'd be able to win back a lot of those more working class voters in that part of America that Trump managed to win over. So that doesn't surprise me at all. He's basically giving back the stuff that to a lot of the demographic that ended up carrying him to the presidency, right? That to me makes sense. But the Trumpism, I don't know, I feel like that kind of level of policy isn't what I think about when I think of Trumpism. I think of stuff like the Muslim travel ban. I think of stuff like the border wall. I think of stuff like not taking data from people who are not legally settled in the United States and censuses, all things that Biden decided to roll back and reverse in his first on his first day. And that's kind of what I am looking at when I think of Trumpism basically being rubbed out. I think a lot of people are talking about there being like this long legacy, but with Trump unable to make headlines because he's banned from every outlet that he has used in the past in order to create those headlines, like Facebook and Twitter. I mean, I haven't thought about Trump in like a couple of days. And that feels mad. Oh, it's lovely. It's so freeing.
But isn't it also the question of, I don't even know if Trumpism is really a thing, in the sense that it's not really a governance ideology. It seems to be more a vacuum of governance ideology, which you just have, essentially, you're just a mix of xenophobia and libertarianism, where you say, okay, I don't want the government to do anything and just let itself sort it out. And all the other things that you were mentioning, Jimmy, of the, you know, make or manufacture America or whatnot, is essentially America's policy since at least the 20th century, the middle of it. Because if you look at all the things they've done before, it's always been focused, okay, how do we get American government, for the American economic policy is always, we want to export as much as possible and import as little as possible and give ourselves an advantage. I mean, free trade for the Americans is always not really free trade. Kind of like the British way of
they want
free trade.
except we don't have the ability to manufacture anything in our country anymore.
Sausages.
I don't think even really then.
Sausages. God, this is going to be a short list.
The humble haggis is probably about the only thing that we can manufacture on our own anymore.
But if Scotland leaves, then you lose that too. I mean, when are you going to do that?
Can we not? Was on the short list for topics. We decided no. Go on, Jimmy. Sorry.
But I was going to say that I think one of the main questions, and that this is why the manufacturing thing is important, you know, even as a kind of, as a token's the wrong word, but as a headline pledge, I guess, is the big question I think everyone is asking is, put in slightly corny terms, can Joe Biden heal the nation? You know, can he win back over people who were converted to Trumpism? And I think so far, watching the inauguration, I was like, I don't really see it. I mean, I know there was a lot of like warm rhetoric and like the usual bromides about unity and blah 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 blah, and that, you know, that nice poem as well.
It was a lovely poem, wasn't it, Jimmy?
I mean, it was a sort of mediocre poem. I think it was neither that exciting nor as crap as some of its critics said it was.
You're such a hater.
But I don't see that sort of thing winning over the, you know, the Trumpers. I was reading actually that apparently more than 80% of Trump supporters believe that the election was stolen. I think there was some evidence that actually, sort of just after the Capitol Hill thing, there were lots of like Republican supporters who approved of what the rioters did at Capitol Hill, and that fell down sort of a week or so after it happened. So maybe over time we'll see a similar decay in the number of people who think the election was stolen. But you know, you say Trump hasn't got a legacy. I agree there is no such thing as Trumpism as such, but I think that some of the damage that he's done in terms of eroding trust in, you know, the elections, for, you know, for one thing, I think that is going to be a pretty long legacy of Trump's presidency.
Oh, I definitely agree with that. That's,
Mm-hmm. It's been really interesting. The New York Times has done some brilliant reporting on where all of these, the hardcore Trump voters are, both those that maybe ended up at Capitol Hill a couple of weeks ago, but also those that weren't able to go, but maybe had the sentiments of wanting to be able to go. Seeing them flee a lot of the more mainstream social media sites and applications like Facebook and Twitter, and having Parler shut down, momentarily come back up and then shut down again, WhatsApp having its terms and conditions, a lot of it, some people would say the concerns that these groups had were slightly unfounded in how WhatsApp was going to continue to use user data, but that ended up with a lot of people fleeing to the likes of Telegram, for example, and they seem to be gradually more and more siloed off from even the media that they have been kind of like consuming, and actually making it a lot harder for us to understand properly what is being planned, if anything is being planned, what these people understand and believe. Like I have an innate distrust of kind of like surveillance, but if you don't know what these people are thinking and talking about, then you can't try and bring them along with you and cause that healing that Joe Biden talks about, right? And I really worry about that shift into, I mean, to call it darker parts of the internet is very, and that's a leading adjective, isn't it?
It's also, it's not really surveillance if somebody's posting it on a public forum such as Facebook. Do you know what I mean?
But they're not. It's not a public forum anymore. If it's in a WhatsApp group or if it's in Telegram.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. I'm just saying that the fact that they've moved off some of these, you know, the likes of Twitter. That wasn't really. If you post something there, it's not. You can't really complain you're being surveilled. I don't think that doesn't really make sense.
If you shout it in the middle of the street, then you can't also really say like, oh. Yeah, exactly.
But how did you know what I said?
I didn't say those nasty things. Mm-hmm. We have a video of you on the street doing it. Must have done it.
Tiri, this is probably a stupid question. We're going to ask it anyway. Is there like a sort of conventional Dutch perspective on these kind of things? Like, what do you guys make of the inauguration and the transfer of power?
I mean, to speak for all 17 million Dutch people.
That's what I wanted to do.
Yeah. Why else do you think you are?
In general, the looking at American politics is kind of like, oh man, these people are so nuts. I mean, just to paraphrase. even though we've actually this year seen what I would call American situations, politicians being harassed in the middle of the street by sort of right-wing personalities and stuff like this, which was, I would say, in the past quite alien to Dutch politics and Dutch civil discourse. But it's coming up now as well. I mean, beyond that, the inauguration, everybody does kind of hope it is this sort of moment of healing and getting back the America that we're used to, because I think maybe after the UK, the Netherlands is one of the more pro-US countries in the European continent. And so seeing Trump sort of go away and somebody else coming back that we can all look as sort of, you know, Obama part two is, yeah, for Dutch, I think it's quite comforting in a sense, I would say. Beyond that, I don't know if we're too, yeah, the pendulum of it goes back to some Republican at some point, you know, it will happen at some point, and we have to live with that then. Hopefully it'll be a more normal Republican. I don't know. Remember when we thought George W. Bush was the worst president they had? Those were good times.
The halcyon days of like the early noughties, man. Halcyon days. It was 9/11. Let's be fair, and the Iraq War. That's what we were. But it's easy to think about it as really great when you're not living through it right now. Oh God, I remember when the Iraq War was like the worst thing that possibly happened. It was really pretty bad, actually. To be fair,
I've got to be honest. I think the Iraq War is still much worse than most of what's happened in Britain and America in the last 10 years.
True. Trump has also actually not really done anything in the 4 years he was. He shouted a lot.
Remarkably ineffective.
Yeah, which I think is a blessing because he was so bad. He was literally so bad at his job that he didn't do anything except, you know.
What happened? So if he's currently in the process of being, they're going to start trying him in the Senate. He's already been impeached. Half of all American impeachments have happened to Trump.
That was a great stat.
I don't really understand how this works, but he is going to be tried in the Senate to be removed. Obviously, he isn't president anymore, so I don't really understand what that really means practically, but it does mean that he isn't going to be able to run again.
Yes, well, that is one of the things. If they convict him, they can bar him from holding any federal office, I think. Mm-hmm, maybe any state
which
office.
Which is a separate
vote. Oh, is it a separate vote? I didn't realize that. Yeah.
It's because I read somewhere that for impeachment, you need 60 senators. And for this vote on making sure he can't run again, you just need a simple majority.
Oh, I mean, that feels totally doable, right?
I don't understand if you can do the vote to bar him before you convict him. I don't understand how those two are exactly related.
Yeah.
Complicated.
But that's kind of like the next step for the United States is poor Biden. Like, all he wants to do is get on and kind of have some headlines. And that ain't going to happen probably for the next 100 days or so while they continue to try him in the Senate. But oh well, such is life. Bless him. So, Jimmy, can you tell me what the Wellerman, soon may he come, is meant to bring us? Is it sugar and tea and rum? Yes, it is.
You didn't even let me have a chance to answer that question, which is good because I did not know the answer. But you're referring to the sea shanty that our four lads from the infamous meme that we already mentioned.
They were deep faked. Yeah, they were. Well, they didn't participate in it. This image of them that was memed like last year, maybe a little bit earlier. No, it would have been 2019 that it was 2019, that it first did the rounds on the internet. They were deep faked to sing the shanty, the sea shanty, the "Oh, soon may the willow men come to bring us sugar and tea and rum."
Okay, so one. There's the deep fake one, and there's also the four of them.
Oh, they sang it.
They've also done. No, they lip synced to another track, another sea shanty. I'm not sure it was the same one.
I think it's the same one, but that was after they were deep faked, I believe.
Yes, they were deep faked first. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think we're getting to the nitty gritty of this a little bit too early.
Sure. Sorry. You please set the beautiful scene.
So, as mentioned at the start of this podcast, our friend Brendan O'Neill, who of Corner to Jazz isn't our friend
can
at
you
all.
He isn't. I don't like you.
He seems very interesting. You should have him on the show sometime.
Shut up, Tui.
Troll face that the listeners can't see currently. So Brendan O'Neill wrote in The Spectator that the use of this meme, which occasionally was used to paint these lads as like gamins, to use that phrase, and sort of racist reactionaries, is evidence of like snobbishness among middle-class social media users. Jazza, I think one of the things that struck me as interesting is that I think if this sort of meme had been able to be interpreted as making fun of any other group other than sort of the straight white man, I feel that you probably would have come to a similar conclusion as O'Neill. Is that unfair?
Yeah. So I found Brendan O'Neill's analysis of this really odd, because for me, that's where I come from. Like,
well, they come from Birmingham and Coventry.
Those are the people that I grew up with. That is, I used to go out to O'Neill's and Slug and Lettuce, unironically, to have beers. There just aren't any in Stratford, and I 100% still do if I'm in Essex. Listen to my Essex accent come out again.
with the headphones.
Yeah. and so I found it really strange to hear him talking about this being kind of like snobbery towards the working class, because I don't see myself as working class, and that is actually still how I unironically dress quite a lot of the time. I refuse to give up on the skinny jean, and I love a crisp white shirt, and if I had the balls, I'd have a sleeve tattoo, if I'm completely honest. I've had it planned for about 5 years, and I'd look pretty brilliant in it, to be real. And so I found this claim of it, but don't shake your head at me, Tui.
Sorry.
But I have the it was a really weird mental exercise of Brendan O'Neill putting my identity into working class, because it isn't. And actually, that is what I think they represent is kind of, I don't think it represents working class. I reckon it represents kind of like the aspirational class to a certain extent. Like, and I think that's more broad and more encompassing of kind of like more identities outside of the traditional working middle upper class. Although who the fuck is upper class other than the Queen? Let's be real.
I mean, the Maid in Chelsea cast, I would say.
Well, no, the Maid in Chelsea class, I think, fit into this aspirational class of North London would call as like, would probably call common as muck, right? Obsessed with aesthetics, liking to, I unironically drink Grey Goose as well. I think it's my favourite vodka, to be completely honest.
You have a favourite vodka, says enough.
How dare you?
I didn't realise this was going to arouse such defensiveness in Jazza.
No, but I'm just really found it really... So, to be fair, I was aware of, like, the meme and of people kind of, like, being a bit snobby about it. I was like, yeah, whatever. It didn't seem like something that was... I assumed that they would not care about that, and they probably find all of the posh people in North London talking about them in this way, taking the piss out of their skinny jeans. I'm sorry, but skinny jeans continue to look great. But then I was unaware of all of the stuff that kind of happened over the summer, of them being associated with racist reactions and racist responses to Black Lives Matter. Like putting captions underneath the image that said, oh yeah, but you can't tear down like Churchill's statue or whatever, like these ill thought. I was completely unaware of that, and obviously that sucks. But also I found it really strange that Brendan fucking O'Neill,
O'Neill?
Brendan fucking O'Neill, all of a sudden defending, like being on the side of people who were protesting against, protesting for Black Lives Matter in some weird kind of contorted way. I just really dislike his column because it's just reactionary bullshit, frankly.
Okay.
Sorry, I've gotten myself annoyed.
Let Jazza call off for a second, Thierry. What's your take on this as an outsider to
as a foreign? What do you think?
As a foreign, yeah, I thought to myself, this is the most British article I've read in a long time. That was the first thing that came to mind. For me, it's a bit. You see this kind of same thing. It exists everywhere. I don't think any culture is immune to having sort of an upper class. Oh, I'm doing air quotes. Sorry, quote unquote upper class looking down on people they perceive to be lower class. Because we have it in the Netherlands too, and you have it in Belgium as well. It's quite common, and I think it happens all the time. I always think it comes from also a very strong sense of insecurity, actually, from the, you would call it middle class, seeing, okay, these are the people that I think I am better than, but I still have to live next to them, and they still have to work with me, and I still have to live with them, so it's easier for me to make fun of them than to sort of accept that I'm also kind of the same. So I don't know if it's, I don't really understand why the article was so like, oh, this is the moment that the fire is lit and that snobbery is at its worst. There's always snobbery. Rich people are always snobby. It's sort of the inherent default position that they have. And then subsequently, anybody who wants to aspire to that joins in with it. And and on the skinny, I mean, their skinny jeans aren't a bit too, I get a bit skinny, but there's
the one in
Paul's
the middle, his jeans are just too small for him. Like, it's like he's got kids' trousers on, and his decisions were indefensible. He walked into Top Man and went to like the teenager aisle rather than. Like,
I do understand if you go to the gym as much as some of these guys must do, you buy a shirt that technically doesn't fit. I get that, and you have to flaunt what you have. Mm-hmm. That's tough. That would be my sort of. Sober, I guess, look from outside would be, yeah. Even though I do have to say, UK, you do seem culturally to have much more of a focus on class struggle than I would say the Dutch from where I'm sitting. So I feel like every conversation, not every conversation, but these types of topics often come back to which class are you in? Which class do you think you're in? And how do you see that? And I find that, it's always quite interesting because I don't think, not every other country has this. In the same way that you do.
We obsess about it. There's been a load of stuff that I've read in The Guardian recently about people who are very clearly middle class insisting that they are working class or will play up working class roots that they have.
Isn't that what you just said about yourself?
No, I'm not working class. Like the closest thing to my mum legitimately is. My dad probably isn't.
What makes your mom working class?
Because she grew up in a slum in Bristol. like she legitimately didn't have.
It's defined about where you are from/grew up. Then I guess
no. But she's middle class now, but you try telling her that.
Because she likes being working class, right? Working class is...
Yeah, it's a good thing. I think that's actually one of the things that the UK has, is that there is this romanticism about the working class that doesn't necessarily exist in other parts of the world nearly as much. Like, it is seen as a really positive thing to be working class or to become, to be from the working class. It's the whole idea of, like, the British underdog. We love an underdog. And if you've managed to pull yourself kicking and screaming out of St. Paul's in Bristol, like my mum did, then it's probably a point of pride for you, you know?
And by the way, I don't think other countries have the same thing, but it just always feels very overt in the UK.
Mm-hmm.
Like it's talked about in such specific terms, but it's always very difficult to define exactly how, where one starts and the other begins. I never know.
But yeah, like, to be clear as well, I'm not like, because these people look like the people that I grew up with, I am therefore not attaching myself to their class struggle. We don't know how they would identify.
Well, three of them are construction workers, which is a working class
work in construction. They are not necessarily construction workers.
Yeah, fair point.
One of them is a tattoo artist. We don't, and nobody, like all of these, like the Tab and Brendan fucking O'Neill, seem to have bestowed the working class label on them. They don't bloody know that about these guys.
I think from their houses,
I reckon that they look pretty. They're doing all right to me. They've got some lovely wallpaper.
I mean, you know, I can't speak to what class they define themselves as, but I think it's not totally unreasonable of O'Neill to look at that photo and assume that they're working class. I don't think that's a crazy jump to make. Personally,
they do fit in a lot of the stereotypes we have in the reality TV show, so it's kind of hard not to put them in there.
I suppose there's also this wider point that, like, you know, that kind of overt materialism that they seem to be conforming to in caring that much about their appearance is associated with working class mores, probably unfairly, I think. But
I'd rather not sound this middle class, but it's the nouveau riche, isn't it? It's why it's such a big thing in Essex, because Essex is full of people who were very recently working class and then through generally deregulation and Thatcherism ended up making a fuck ton of money. Hmm. And then decided to spend it on big houses, tacky cars and fake tan.
Yeah. But
to be fair, two out of those things, anyone who has a lot of money spends it on houses, quote unquote.
And fake tan.
Nice attack. Okay. Well, fake tan is a thing a little bit more. I see so many people with fake tans nowadays that I just go, I feel like I missed something a decade ago where all of a sudden now I look around like, everybody's got a fake tan. Should I get a fake tan? No, I shouldn't get a fake tan.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, it's one of the things.
I can confirm, Tui, you should not get a fake tan.
Thanks, Jeff.
I think you should give it a go. Send us the photo evidence of what happens.
I'll ask my fiance, see what she thinks.
Yeah. But yeah, I just found it so detached and weird for this to be defined as like a class struggle thing when that doesn't feel like stuff that is tied to class for me anyway at all. Like, people who are middle class look and act like that. People who are working class look and act like that. It is not like that. The only way is Essex. Kind of like chavvy aesthetic is not something that defines the working class. What does, I think, define the working class is your ability to have stable work or to be able to feed your kids or whatever, you know? Like, I don't think it's the fact that you wear a shirt that's too tight.
I think we might have to put a pin in this discussion for now. I'm sure there's lots
more
that we can say.
Put a pin in you in a minute.
Say about class in the UK and beyond.
If you bring me another Brendan O'Neill article in the next month, I'm murdering you.
Well, based on what Turi said about why he listens to the podcast, I'm definitely bringing you another Brendan O'Neill article.
I would say you should do that.
At some stage in the future. Turi, where can our listeners find you on the internet if they want to ask you?
Do you want to be found?
Yeah.
Do I want to be found? I have nothing interesting that can be found. So you could find me on Twitter, Turi Fiorito 86. But to be fair, I don't know if I have that many interesting things to say. It's just going to be a lot of Star Wars retweets and things that I like about politics.
Well, great. Thanks for saying that after we've had you on as a guest on the podcast. Jimmy, where can we find you on the internet, if at all?
You can still find me on Twitter at JDE Nichols. Although, as I've said previously, I'm not active anymore.
It's a lie. And then you can find me at Jazza John on all social media platforms. Maybe one day I will upload a YouTube video again. Who the fuck knows? It'll probably be about Eurovision.
Yeah, maybe I'll even watch it. But I'm not going to make any
promises.
No, you won't.
You haven't watched me since, like, 2017, Jimmy. Don't lie.
That's very unfair, but accurate.
When was your last video, Jazza?
It was, I think, May last year. I've been doing loads of streams, though. I accidentally streamed explicit material on YouTube a couple of weeks ago. That was fun.
Well, why didn't you leave with that? You know, people will start watching your YouTube videos if they realise
that. Oh, that is. Oh, there's actual porn sites for that shit, Jimmy. Go down that rabbit hole. Okay. Bye, everyone.
Bye-bye.
Bye, everybody.